So welcome to the course, everybody. So I'm sure you're in the right room for the right course. This is an advanced course in general relativity, and I recognize some people here coming from Guelph, and I'm sure I recognize some people coming from Waterloo. So welcome, everybody. So what I'll do here, first I'll get through the course logistics, the boring details that we all need to be aware of before we get started with the course, and then I'll tell you about what I intend this course to be, and then we'll get started with the material. So the most important thing here in terms of course logistics is that you get all access to CourseLink. So CourseLink is a system that we use in Guelph, so it's really Guelph-based, and it seems to be very entrenched in Guelph. So I know for you Waterloo students, it's not so easy to get access to this, and I apologize for all the difficulties. I was looking at the class list last night, and I noticed that all of you Waterloo folks have been given a U of G email address. I don't know why that's necessary, but apparently it is. Anyway, so you need to get onto CourseLink because that's going to be the central hub for the course. So that's where I'm posting all sorts of things. That's where I'll be making announcements. That's where I'll be telling you what the homework assignments are. So you really need to get your hands on this and keep track of it. So I have a look at it once in a while. When there's an urgent message that I need to send out, for example, there's a snow day and that day we'll be meeting over Zoom instead of meeting in the classroom, I'll send it out through the class list email list that is within CourseLink. So it's really, it's really important that you get access to this. If you have problems, I apologize, but I can't help you with this. You'll have to figure it out, with the proper authorities. Anyway, so CourseLink contains all sorts of things, in particular announcements, as I say. So, whenever I have something to tell you, it's going to be posted on CourseLink. And when it's really urgent, I'll be emailing that. And then I've posted all sorts of things. I've posted a copy of the textbook, so you don't have to buy it, even though it would make me richer if you did. And then there's going to be the lecture notes, so the handwritten notes that I've prepared. I've posted some of that. I'll keep doing this. And then there's going to be some additional documents that I'll post in support of the course. So, you'll find all sorts of good things there. So the course is going to be based on homework assignments. The marks for the course is going to be based on homework assignments and a term paper and a presentation on the term paper. So the homework assignments, I think there's going to be four, and the first one has been posted already, so you can get started. You can get started right away if you wish. And they're going to keep coming throughout the semester, and that's going to be 60% of the marks. So that's where I expect you'll do most of the work and do most of the learning, because there's no substitute to solving problems in order to learn something. Even though I believe that I teach brilliantly and that, the transfer of knowledge from me to you should be perfectly, perfect and everything, but somehow that never seems to work. So, you'll need to do your own work. And then the term paper, the idea here, that's going to be 40%. The idea here is that I want you to learn something in this course, and I want the learning to go beyond what I'll be teaching you. So I want really to, for you to pick a topic that you find is interesting and go dig so that you get to learn something about that topic. The only rule here is that it cannot be your topic of research. So if you're doing a master's thesis or a PhD thesis on a given topic, you're not allowed to use that as a topic for the term paper. That would be cheating, that would be defeating the purpose, which is to learn something new. So I want you to find something and go learn about it. I'm giving you complete freedom in finding that topic, but I want to verify that. So I'm going to be asking you on February 14th to submit a paragraph or two on what the topic is and what you intend to do with it, and maybe indicate some of the sources that you're going to be consulting. And then I'm going to look at this, and if I find that it's appropriate for the course, I'll say, yes, go for it. If it's something having to do with nothing to do with GR at all, I will say, well, maybe that's not such a good idea, and we'll have a discussion. But, I really want you to find the topic that you're interested in, and then I want you to, go at your own discretion into that topic and learn as much as you can. So you'll all be asking me how long should the term paper be, and I won't tell you what the answer is. So that's really up to you. If you submit 2 pages, maybe I'm not going to be satisfied. If you submit 100 pages, maybe I'll be overwhelmed. So, somewhere in between. The point is that I want you to go deep. I want you to dig into that topic. I don't expect you to do necessarily independent calculations. I don't expect you to publish a paper on that topic at the end of the day, but you could surprise me, and that could be a great thing that happens from all of this. But the point is that I want something substantial, something that really reflects that you've learned something, and that you can transmit that knowledge through a term paper. And at the end of the term, we'll have a presentation where each of you will be invited to give a talk on that topic, probably around 15 or 20 minutes or so. And then all of us will benefit from what you've learned, because you're going to be transmitting that to us. So that's the idea. So no exams. I think we've grown up. We don't have to do that anymore. And the whole point of all this is I want you to learn. I want you to, learn with my help and without my help. I want you to, do something that you couldn't do before in that general topic of general relativity, but that includes gravitational physics as a whole, and one of your topics might be some alternative theory of gravity. Why not? So we're not restricted to pure GR, but something having to do with gravity. So that's the idea, and I think that takes care of the logistics, and you can find more details and all the dates and everything in the course outline that I've posted on CourseLink. So that's going to be homework number one, or number zero: find the course outline and make sure you're aware of all the legalistic aspects having to do with the course. Any questions at this point? All good? Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about the course as a whole, my vision for the course and what I intend to do with it. And before I get going, I'll wear my white glove. So sometimes I don't tell you why I do this, but I'll tell you it's because my hand gets dry from the chalk, and then I get all those cuts, and it's very painful, and that helps. All right, so I was looking at my career last night, because I wanted, so I've been giving this course for quite some time, and it turns out that the first time I gave this course was exactly 25 years ago. And I would be willing to put money on the table saying that none of you were born at that time. So that's how old the course is. And the course has not changed all that much over those 25 years, because the topics that I cover in this course are not topics that reflect, what's happened in the field for the last 5 years or so. It's really, stuff that are fundamental to general relativity, things that are not changing, all that rapidly. So it's a pretty well-established course. It's a pretty well, mature course, but nevertheless, this time around, because it had been some time since I taught the course the last time, I think it's been about 10 years, I decided, it was time maybe to revise a few things. So that's why I posted my handwritten lecture notes on top of the textbook in CourseLink, because, I'm going to do things slightly differently from time to time. So things that I'll do in the lectures, you won't find directly in the book. So anyway, it's an old course, and when I introduced the course, the vision that I had, and it's still the same vision I'm having now, is that, there are all sorts of things that people seem to know when they do research in general relativity or alternative theories of gravity that everybody seems to know, as I said, but you couldn't find in textbooks. I mean, all sorts of useful techniques that, I was using in my research, others were using in their research, where everybody seemed to know about these things and learned them from from somewhere, but it never seemed to be stuff that would find itself in textbooks. Now the situation has changed, because I did write a textbook, so now it's not so true anymore. But nevertheless, I think those are useful things that everybody should know if you're going to be working in that field and things that I'm hoping will help you, you know, carry out your own research, maybe not immediately, maybe not today, but, you know, at some point, maybe you're going to need something like this to set up a calculation that you want to do. And, you know, the good thing about having taught a course for 25 years is that I've had, you know, quite a few testimonies over the years about people who said, oh yeah, to do my research, I really had to use those techniques, some of those techniques that you put in the book, and thank you. So, you know, that's the kind of testimony that I get. I was lucky. I never got, you know, hate mail or anything like that about the book. So, you know, that's pretty good these days. And then that was the idea, to teach techniques that are important and not so easily found in textbooks. But I didn't want that to be just a collection of things that you should know. I wanted to put those techniques to use. So, of course, being a big fan of black holes, I decided that the best thing to do in the course would be to collect all the techniques that, well, maybe not all, but, you know, a lot of the techniques that are required when you want to study black holes at a fairly deep level, beyond just writing the Schwarzschild solution and playing around with geodesics and things like that. So, you know, go about discussing the laws of black hole mechanics and all of those good things. That requires a little bit of an advanced setup that that I'm planning to provide here. So that's the idea. We're going to talk about all sorts of little things, and in the end, I'm going to put all of those things together in a study of black holes. And that's not to say that all of those little things that I'll be introducing are devoid of their own interest, and we'll consider examples and applications as they come, but the vision is really to gather a lot of tools so that at the end, toward the end of the course, we can do black holes at, you know, a very deep level. So that's the idea. Let's see, what did I have? There's something I wanted to say at this point that I'm forgetting. Sorry, bear with me for just a minute. Yeah. Anyway, so I won't give you a listing of, you know, of topics or anything like that. I think we'll get into that as we get into it, and you can get that from the course outline. Anyway, so basically we'll get started from, you know, from pretty much the beginning, and then build it up from there. And that brings me to, you know, what I mean by beginning. So this is an advanced course, so I'm going to make assumptions about what I think you should know by now, and it's not a matter of judgment, it's just that in order to teach, I have to assume what you know and then go beyond that. So I'm assuming that you all took some kind of course, maybe a first course in GR, maybe you did some self-reading, maybe you did something that would prepare you for a discussion at an advanced level of general relativity. So I'm going to make some assumptions like, you know what covariant derivatives are, you know what a Riemann tensor is, you know what the Einstein field equations are, you know some of the basic solutions like Schwarzschild and, you know, cosmological spacetimes and things like that. So typical stuff that you would find in a first course, I'm assuming that you know something about. Although I will get started from almost the beginning, but mostly at a pretty, you know, high level, so that if this was your first course, I mean, maybe that would be a bit of a difficult thing to manage. But anyway, you'll see how you go, right? I mean, so depending on your knowledge, and if there are things that don't seem to make any sense or things that seem to be too far away for you to remember, then I think it's going to be on you to make sure that all the basic stuff are under your, you know, control, and then we'll go from here. I should say that, you know, I like to start my courses pretty slowly, so I really take my time to get started. So if you feel alarmed that things are not going very fast, just bear with me for a few lectures, and then I think you'll see the, you know, you'll see the rate increasing as we keep going. If you think I'm going hopelessly fast in the first lecture, well, that might be that maybe your background is not really what it should be for this course, and then you'll have some thinking to do. But anyway, I think we'll be fine, and I think I think we can see how it goes, and then make adjustments along the way if we have to. So in terms of the lectures, I'm really grateful when one of you asks a question, because I think it's a lot more interesting for everybody when there are some interruptions in my monologue. I don't mind keeping talking, but I do find myself boring. So, you know, it's a lot more interesting when you step in and ask something, either for clarification or make a comment or anything like this. And I think there is a usual fear that goes with it. Am I going to look foolish if I ask a stupid question? The answer is yes, but you know, who cares? So the point is that if a question occurs to you, chances are it occurred to somebody else, and maybe you'll be the brave one who actually asks the questions as opposed to let it linger and, you know, something that, you know, should have been stated for better clarity and for, you know, better understanding of the materials. So the idea is that, well, you are supposed to be in charge of your education, and that means that in the course of a lecture like this, well, you have to make sure that if something is not clear to you, you do something about it. And that could mean asking a question during class, or it could mean asking a question after class. But, you know, bottom line is that you have to be engaged in your own education, and that means, you know, manifesting yourself when the time comes. Okay, so that's the idea for the course. We're going to learn all sorts of little things, and then we'll apply them to black holes when the time comes. And I'm going to start with a few fundamental things. So the first chapter of the book is called Fundamentals, and it's a bit of a review of all the things that, you know, many of the things that you have learned in the first course. So I want to go over that a little bit. It's not going to be extremely systematic because I expect you know a lot of this stuff, but I want to make some points that I consider to be, you know, pretty important, and maybe cover some things that you haven't, covered previously. So one example of this is in a few minutes I'll start talking about Lie derivatives, something that you may have learned already, something that you may not have learned already, but it's a very important thing that we need to have at our disposal in this course. So I'll take the time to introduce this. In a way, by the way, that's much better that's what in the textbook. So when I wrote that section in the textbook, when I first wrote it, I did something, and in the course of time, I decided that I didn't like that approach very much, and I came up with a much better way of introducing something so important as the Lie derivative, and we're going to go through that in the lecture today. Okay, so let's go ahead. And the fundamentals I'm talking about are basically the tools of differential geometry. So that's what it really means. We're going to look at something related to differential geometry without necessarily thinking too much about the gravity implications, but that will come soon enough. And the first thing about this is that, well, differential geometry can mean a lot of things. And in fact, there's a big continuum of ideas that are associated with differential geometry. So here is the continuum. And at one extreme is where, you know, physics tends to be, and that's called tensor calculus. And at the other extreme is where the mathematicians like to be, and that's called, you know, I will call it abstract differential geometry. And someone who lives here would have no clue about what's going on there. And someone who lives here would find all of this stuff very, very strange and very, very pedestrian. So where do we live? Where do I live? Well, I'm a physicist, so I live here. I think I'm a little bit more sophisticated than the old, description of tensor calculus, where basically vectors were defined as how they transform with the Cantor transformations. That's really ugly, and it's, you know, something that, well, is necessary at some point to know something about, but it's really ugly and very pedestrian and really, you know, defeating the point of view of introducing geometry into physics. But when I go too deep into the other direction, I find myself, and I'm talking about my own limitation here, having great difficulty absorbing all the abstraction that goes on when we go into the deep mathematical world of differential geometry. So I get lost very quickly. And then even if I make an effort someday to try to learn something about, for example, diffeomorphisms, things that are really fundamental in that part of the world, I find that, well, after a couple of weeks, I completely forgot about all this, and you know, and then I have to start all over again. So that's, I'm talking about my own limitation here. I'm talking about the fact that I'm a physicist, and as a physicist, I like to do things a little bit more, you know, in a way that's a bit more sophisticated than the old tensor calculus ways. But still, you know, I still like to introduce coordinates. So one thing about this continuum is that as you go along the line here, we're going from a situation where the coordinates, you know, are everywhere in the tensor calculus approach. You know, vectors are things that are defined according to how they transform under a coordinate transformation. So coordinates are everywhere. And in this part of the world, well, coordinates are nowhere to be found. And in fact, in this part of the world, coordinates have a bad reputation. You're supposed to do all of your work at the conceptual level, you know, the rarefied world of mathematics where everything is nice and precise and rigorous and completely abstract without coordinates. Well, as a physicist, I, you know, reject that because, you know, at some point I want to calculate something that may, you know, give me a prediction about, you know, black holes, so you know, how they behave if you throw matter at them or something like that. And every time I want to calculate something and get a concrete result, well, the first thing I have to do typically is to introduce a coordinate system. I wouldn't know how to do my work in physics without coordinates. So that's why I'm sort of happier in this part of the world where coordinates are still considered to be legitimate. And I'm finding myself, you know, having difficulty going into the completely abstract, you know, way of doing things that mathematicians like, because, you know, I have a hard time starting here and figuring out how I'm supposed to introduce coordinates to do my work. So that's the idea. So, you know, the kind of presentation that I'll give you here, I think is still deeply geometrical. So I'm not going to define vectors as how they transform or the coordinate transformations. That's really, you know, too much of an extreme for me, but still, we'll be using coordinates. We won't be shy about this, and I'll never apologize for introducing coordinates that help me do a calculation. So for me, that's the bottom line. You know, if coordinates are useful, use them, and don't be, you know, don't be shy about that. Don't be, you know, don't be embarrassed to use coordinates. They're here to help, and why not, you know, why not get that help? Okay, so a couple of points about vectors. So here, typically, I mean, the setting here is that we're going to be talking about four-dimensional space-time with a metric and all of those things. But, you know, a lot of what I'm going to say here would apply to more, you know, more general situations, but I'm not going to insist on that. So when we're introduced to vectors in our undergraduate schooling, we're thinking of a vector as an arrow that points from point to point in space. So we have a point here called A, and then we have another point B, and then a vector is going to be some arrow that, you know, that relates those two things, that links those two points. And when we generalize this to curved spacetimes, so or curved manifolds in general, we have to realize that while this way of thinking about vectors is completely inadequate, it doesn't work. And an example of this is, well, draw the surface of a sphere. So now we're going to be working on the surface of a sphere. And if I had two points on the surface of a sphere, can I draw an arrow between those two points? And the answer is, well, sure, but you would have to do some strange things if you attempted to do that. For example, is the arrow pointing between the two, is it supposed to follow the curvature of the surface? And is it going to be a, you know, an arrow that curves like this? You know, do I draw it like that? Or, you know, is it supposed to go through the Earth? You still draw it straight, but now it goes through the Earth. And the bottom line is that while none of this makes sense and none of this, you know, is something that you could really build as a precise mathematical notion of vectors in a curved space-time. or curved space in more general terms. So the point of the vector staying straight but going through the going through the volume of the Earth, well, that doesn't work because, well, we're only working on the surface of the Earth. When we only work on the surface, the inside may not be defined mathematically, and to have a vector that goes through that undefined interior just doesn't make mathematical sense. And to have an arrow that curves around like this, well, you would have to specify all the rules of the curving, and well, basically, it just doesn't make any sense. So bottom line is that when we go from the sort of most elementary notions of vectors to something that can be formalized in a curve manifold, well, we have to make some changes of thinking. So that's the first point I wanted to make. So I'm going to redraw this this curve manifold. So we're going to still be thinking of the surface of the sphere. And the idea is that, well, if I introduce a point on the surface of the sphere, I can introduce vectors at that point. And those vectors are not going to live on the manifold itself. They're going to live on a tangent space attached to that point. So I can draw a flat tangent space like this, and I can draw any number of vectors attached to that point. And the idea is that all of those vectors belong to that point, and they live in that tangent space. So vectors live at a tangent space that's attached to any given point. And if I draw a second point, B, I can introduce another tangent space at that point, and I can define vectors at that point, and those will live in a very different tangent space, and those tangent spaces will form distinct vector spaces. So vectors at different points live in distinct tangent spaces. And those things here are distinct vector spaces. So within each vector space, we can do the usual vector operations. We can add vectors, we can subtract, we can rescale, we can do all of those things. But all of those operations are limited to one given vector space. We cannot combine vectors in different vector spaces. They really belong to different mathematical worlds. And that's one of the, you know, things that we have to face when we work in curved manifolds, the fact that vectors at different points are not supposed to talk to one another. All right, so that's a first observation that I think is important and something that we're going to come back to in just a few minutes. The other thing that's important in differential geometry is the fact that we can always associate, so when we're dealing with a vector field, so that I'm talking about a vector that's defined at each point on the manifold, or at least in some region of the manifold. So when we have a vector defined at different points, we still are talking about different points being associated to different vector fields, but we have a vector assignment for each of those points. So if we're dealing with a vector field, we can always put them in a one-to-one correspondence between their the integral curves of that vector field. And I'll just tell you what that is in just a moment. So suppose that, I'm not going to insist on the curve nature of the manifold here, but suppose that I have a manifold and I have an assignment for a vector at each point. So that's what we mean by a vector field. So I have one point over here, and the vector v is defined at that point. I have another point here, and the vector is defined at that point. And then maybe I have another one over here, and the vector is defined at that point. And the idea is that we're supposed to have, you know, a vector defined at each point, and that's our vector field. Once we have that, we also have, almost automatically, a network of curves at each point in the manifold to which the vector is tangent. So at that point here, I can draw a curve, and that's going to be called an integral curve. And the property of that curve is that at each point on that curve, we have the vector field V being tangent to that curve. And those are called integral curves. So the integral curves are curves to which V is tangent. And the way to establish the correspondence is just to say that, well, if you start with, before I say that, I should say that the curves are going to be described in terms of equations on that manifold. And here is where I introduce coordinates. And I will say that, well, the integral curves are going to be defined as parameterized curves on that manifold. And that means that all of the coordinates are going to be assigned to be a function of some parameter lambda. So, you know, each point on the curve here will correspond to one value for the lambda parameter, and lambda will keep running on the curve, and we're defining the curve as a parameterized curve. So those integral curves are going to be described mathematically like this, like any parameterized curve in any kind of mathematical setting. And the correspondence between the two is simply to say that, well, if we start with the vector field, then we're going to find those functions by making sure that the derivative of the functions with respect to lambda gives us the vector field. So that's the statement that if I differentiate the curve, I get the tangent vector, and the tangent vector to the curve is going to be coincident with the vector field that we started with. So the idea here is that, you know, in one reading of this, we start with the vector field as being predefined, and then we're going to solve this system of differential equations to find the curves. So that's what you would do, for example, if you were given an electric field and you wanted to get the field lines, you know, you would make this equal to the electric field, and the field lines would be solutions to that equation. This is a first order, it's a system of first order differential equations. The solution will be unique once you provide initial conditions, and the initial conditions will be, well, you know, the value of the coordinates at lambda equal to zero is going to be provided. So, you know, so the point is that the system of differential equations will come with some very specific, boundary conditions, and the boundary conditions will tell you that, well, if you integrate this with this boundary conditions, you're basically working at that point, and you're integrating away from that point, either in the positive or negative lambda direction, and you're generating the whole curve from the starting value that's given at that point over here. And then as you keep altering this, considering different boundary conditions, then you're moving from this point to that point to this point, and then you can generate the whole, you know, sequence of curves this way. And the idea is that if you're dealing with a vector field that's, you know, nice and regular and smooth and everything, and is not multivalued anywhere or anything like that, then you will get a nice network of curves that are guaranteed to just coexist peacefully without intersecting or anything like that. Because if you generated, you know, integral curves that intersect, that would mean that the tangent vector at that point could either be that one or this one. And that would mean that the vector field is multivalued at that point. That would correspond to a singular vector field. And here I'm excluding that from our considerations. All right, so the point here is that if we start with a vector field, then we have a vector at every point. Through every point, we can draw a curve to which the vector is tangent. And the whole network of those curves are called the integral curves. And mathematically, we just get them by solving a system of first-order differential equations with initial conditions corresponding to each choice of point we can make. And once we've selected the point, we get the whole curve through that point. And that gives us the integral curves from the vector field. So that's the correspondence where we start with the vector field and get the whole system of integral curves. What we could do instead is to start with the curves. We might start with a set of curves defined for us, and then that would mean that those functions are predetermined, and then all we would have to do to get the vector field is to take that derivative. So we can either go that way or this way, and therefore we have a correspondence going both ways, and that's what I meant by a one-to-one correspondence between a vector field and a set of integral curves. So I'm going to be using those integral curve ideas quite a bit in the next little while, so that's an important idea, so that's why I took the time to flesh it out a little bit. And it turns out that, while in abstract differential geometry, that correspondence between vectors and integral curves turns out to be, very fundamental, so that's the kind of thing that is used to even define what vector fields are. They're defined to be tangent to curves. And even for vectors that have nothing to do with being tangent to any curve, it's always good to think or, to keep in mind that we can always, go back and forth between any vector field and the integral curves. And an example of this is the electric field. So, the electric field lines are something that we do as physicists to help visualize things. But we can always go back and forth between the electric field itself, which is the fundamental thing, and the field lines that we can represent it with, and vice versa. So that's the idea. So whenever we're presented with a vector field, we can always think of it as being in a one-to-one correspondence with a set of integral curves. And that turns out to be useful to think along those lines sometimes, and we'll have some examples of this in the near future. All right, any questions about this so far? All good? Okay. So that's the point that I wanted to make about vectors, and then I'll start introducing other things and build up the whole zoology of tensors. Right, So once we have vectors, and that's how we think of vectors as as defined on a manifold, we can introduce additional objects. And the first one that we tend to introduce here are things that we call covectors. Sometimes we call them covectors. Sometimes we call them dual vectors. Sometimes we call them one-forms. It's all the same idea. And these things are defined to be linear functions of vectors into scalars. So it's an operation that we introduce that will give us from a set of vectors a set of scalars. And the way to describe this is simply to say that where we're talking about a collection of objects, I'll call them omega alpha with the index down. And then we'll think of them as acting on vectors in a linear fashion like this. So we'll basically multiply the covector with the vector, and the result is going to be some scalar. So of course I'm using the summation convention here. So what we're given here is a set of components together with a set of components of the vector, and we're acting on the vector with the covector to get a scalar, and that's the typical operation of, contracting the index. But conceptually, it's an important aspect that we're introducing objects that a priori have nothing to do with vectors. They're their own thing. Like vectors, they're defined also at each point in the space-time. Like vectors, they form a vector space. So the set of objects at any given point forms its own vector space that's distinct from the original vector space at that point. So we introduce the vector spaces relating to vectors here and here. Those are distinct. But what I'm doing here is that at each point here, A or B, I'm introducing on top of that a distinct vector space that's going to be now the space of the covectors. So it's called the dual vector space, or the covector space, whatever you want to call it. The point is that we're introducing objects that form their own vector space, but we're introducing an operation between this vector space and that vector space, and it's that linear contraction of one with the other to form a scalar. So conceptually, that's how we introduce these things. In GR, we tend to lose track of what is a vector, what is a covector, because we have the metric that allows us to convert all of these things into each other. But I think it's good to think back and look at the, you know, the conceptual underpinning of this and understand that, at least, you know, in the more abstract version of differential geometry, these things are really very distinct from vectors. And the way to define them is through that operation that we're introducing here. So an example of this would be the gradient of a function that is a covector. And, you know, I think you've seen about that. You've seen this before. So that's the next step. And once we have the covector, we can introduce tensors. And those are going to be linear, multilinear functions. Of vectors and covectors. Into scalars. And the idea here is that while we might have a tensor that we represent, you know, maybe with two indices, maybe one up, maybe one down. And the idea is that, well, again, this is something that is defined as its own, well, in this case, it's a tensor product of tensor spaces. Anyway, let's not belabor all of those, you know, abstract things. But the idea is that what we would do here is to kill those indices by contracting with a covector to kill the alpha index. We would contract it with a vector to kill the beta index. And this operation will give us a scalar. So it's a multilinear function on vectors and covectors, because when we have a vector like this, when we have a tensor like this, it's acting linearly. You know, we multiply either with a covector or with a vector, or both in this case, to get a scalar. So that's how, you know, tensors get introduced in sort of a more abstract version of differential geometry that goes beyond tensor calculus, and all the transformation rules that you would normally see in presentations of tensor calculus will become understood in this context when you define tensors in this way. So in order for this to be a scalar and this transforms in a specific way, this would have to transform also in a very specific way. So you can derive all of those transformation properties from this more sort of proper view of what a covector is and what a tensor is based on those ideas here, where you have a genuine scalar on the right-hand side and, you know, genuine covectors and vectors on the left-hand side. So that's how you can build up this whole, you know, this whole business. Okay, so that's the idea of a tensor. And then, you know, this sort of thing can be generalized to tensors of arbitrary number of indices. So you can introduce a tensor with 24 indices if you wanted to, you know, 8 of which would be upstairs, the remaining bunch would be downstairs. And they would be defined in exactly the same ways, just that you would add the list of covectors and vectors that that tensor needs to act on in order to form a scalar, but the ideas would be exactly the same. Okay. Now, in GR and in metric theories of gravity, of course, there's one particular tensor that we happen to consider to be pretty important, and that's the metric tensor. And the metric tensor, well, the first definition is that, well, it's a two-object, two-index thing, such that if you form a scalar from it by acting on it with two copies of the same vector, what you get here is the squared length of that vector. So it's an object that we can use to define a length of a vector. So, you know, unless you have a metric, we don't have that way of defining the length of that vector, but the metric is precisely what gives us that notion of length, length of a vector. And it's a scalar quantity, and we got that by taking a, you know, taking a tensor and acting on it in a bilinear fashion on two copies of the same vector. If we were acting on different vectors, we would define what's called the scalar product between the two vectors. So the point is that to turn any vector into a scalar measure of any kind, we need a two-index tensor. And that's what the metric does. A strange thing about working in GR is that we work in space-time, and a squared length can either be negative or positive or even zero. And that's something that can create a little bit of a pain sometimes, something that we have to keep track of very carefully, depending on which situation we're talking about. So once we have the metric, we also have the inverse of the metric. So that's something I presume you know. So we can define an inverse. And the idea is that, the standard notation for this is this. And the idea is that if we write down the metric as a matrix, that would be the inverse to that matrix. So it's literally the inverse matrix to that matrix. And the definition of the inverse is that, if you take the inverse matrix, multiply it by the original matrix, then you end up with the identity matrix. And the component, description of this is this. And what we can do is to use the inverse metric to define a length for a covector. So originally, the covector didn't have any notion of length associated with it, but now the metric, or precisely the inverse metric, gives us a notion of squared length for that. And so again, that's something that we can use in order to turn a covector into a scalar. And the interpretation is that, that scalar, in this case, it's going to be the square length of that covector, business. And what we do then is, of course, use the metric and the inverse to convert vectors into covectors. And after a while, we start losing sight of the distinction between those two things. We start losing sight of the fact that they live in different vector spaces and all of the things that mathematicians would take very seriously, we tend to sort of, let escape from our attention as physicists. But that's fine. We do have the metric, so we might as well use it, even if it means that our thinking can get a little bit fuzzy because of, losing sight of all those important ideas. So I can turn a vector into a covector by acting with a metric. So I started out with a vector, I'm acting on it with a metric. And because if I were to act on this with a second vector, I would get a scalar. That means that this thing here would be acting on that vector to get a scalar. So that means that it's a proper covector. So we've used the metric to convert a vector into a covector. We can think like this in a very precise way, but the nice thing about the index notation is that it pretty much takes care of itself. So, you only sum over repeated indices if they occur, one down, one up, and then you look at the placement of the remaining index and it occurs down. So it must define an object with an index down. So it must be a covector. So after a while, you get so used to this that you don't think about it, but sometimes it's good to step back and make sure that we understand all the conceptual underpinnings of all of this, especially when you start talking about with mathematicians, and they get very unhappy with you when you talk about the vector gradient. They say, no, that's not a thing. And then you can understand what they mean if you think about these things a little bit more deeply. So we can do this, and we can also turn a covector into a vector by using the inverse metric. And that's the same story. So by doing this operation over here, it's not just that we've raised the index, but we've also turned something which is properly a covector into something which is properly a vector. So the reason why we can go so freely back and forth between vectors and covectors in GR is because we have that metric, and the metric allows us to get away with a lot of things without even thinking about it, as I said. But it's important to understand that, the metric is very special, and you could do differential geometry on manifolds without a metric. You can do a lot of things where those connections would not be there, and it's good to be aware of this. And at some point, you will be talking to people who are doing that kind of thing. So, for the interest of communication, it's good to have, this level of awareness. Okay, things good so far? Yep.
What's the geometric interpretation of the one chord on the curvature? So for vectors we have errors, right?
Right.
What's for the collectors?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So I learned a lot of this stuff by reading MTW, so the big book on gravity. And what they propose as a geometric interpretation is, okay, you have vectors drawn as arrows, and what you're going to do is to draw covectors as a whole bunch of parallel planes. At least that would be what you would do in flat spacetime. So that would be the vector in geometrical terms, that would be the covector in geometrical terms, and the operation of turning those two things into a scalar would be counting the bungs of bells that occurs when the vector pierces through that stack of surfaces. Well, the bungs of bells didn't appeal to a lot of people. And that kind of, you know, that kind of representation is really, really, you know, it's not really appealing. I mean, it sort of works, but it's not terribly appealing. And I don't think anybody's really, you know, going forward with this. I mean, they've tried that for one forms, and then for two forms, they try to have something that looks like a honeycomb of stacked surfaces, and, you know, it just didn't catch on.
It's not helpful anyway, right?
It's not terribly helpful. So I think at some point, it's good to, you know, mental pictures are good, physical pictures are good, but sometimes they stop helping. The, you know, the returns get diminished. And I think it's good to think of this on a more abstract level and deal with this. But, you know, it really depends on your personality and how you like to you know, think about things. So that's an option that you would have if you wanted it. So, yeah, thanks for the question.
Sorry, can you elaborate on the bungs of bells?
Oh, yeah. So the idea is that, okay, so we're given a vector, and then we're given a one form, and then the operation of doing this operation over here on top there, the contraction of one with the other, so they're thinking of this as the arrow going through the stack of surfaces, and every time it meets one, there's a bell that goes off. And if by going through you've, you know, you've generated five occurrences of the bell, then your scalar product is going to be five. That sort of thing. So it really measures the degree by which you can pierce those stack of surfaces by that vector.
How can the covector be represented?
No, the vector is the arrow. The covector is that stack of surfaces.
Right, but how can the covector be represented?
I can't answer that. You just do it. Right. So you know, different covectors will correspond to different stacks of different thickness, different orientation, and all of that would give you basically a way of making sort of visual sense of this operation. But, you know, I'm not going to blame you if you're not terribly satisfied with this, because I don't think anybody was really. I mean, that's something that they tried in that book, and I don't think it really caught on. And there was something a little bit childish about this whole attempt. So it didn't survive, really. But you can still find it in the book.
What if it's 5.5?
Yeah, so, you know, so, yeah, so, yeah. So maybe, you know, there was another surface here, and then there's a little bit of a leftover. So it's supposed to be a whole continuum, right? So, yeah, so let's not delve into this. Let's not dwell on that, because it's, you know, it's a little bit silly. Although, you know, it's good to ask about ways to visualize things, but sometimes, you know, it can be pushed a little far, and then, you know, you can agree that, well, it was a good attempt, but it didn't really help me visualize anything, so let's just abandon this whole idea. All right. Other questions before we move on? Okay, good. So please keep this coming. I really enjoy these kinds of discussions. Okay, so those are the basic objects of differential geometry. And the next step is going to be to try to think about what we might do to define a derivative of a vector field. And here we're really in trouble, so I'll introduce the section first. Because, you know, the idea of taking a derivative is really to take a difference between two things at different points and measuring the difference in the derivative. But here I insisted that, you know, our vectors are supposed to be holding to their points of origin. We're not allowed to take this vector and subtract it from that vector to calculate a difference, because those vectors, we insist, and it's perfectly correct, are not to be combined because they live in distinct vector spaces because they belong to different points on a manifold. Yet we know that if we want to do physics, we're going to have to differentiate vector fields all the time. So there has to be a way to do this. And the way to do this, well, I'm going to use two ways of doing it. One is through covariant derivatives, which means let's bring a connection into the picture. And the other one is going to be through a Lie derivative, which doesn't require a connection. So very different ways of handling the situation, and each playing very different roles, but very important roles in differential geometry and in GR. All right. So we have a curved manifold. So I'm going to introduce a vector at Q and a vector at P. And I'm going to think of this as a vector field. So I have a definition for the vector field V at each point. And I would like to introduce a derivative for that vector field to measure the change of V as we go from P to Q. But we're told that we can't do this. We can't do this because we cannot take a difference between vector fields defined in different vector spaces. So the way to go about this is to introduce what's known as a connection. So we need a connection, and we denote it gamma. And what is gamma? Well, that connection is going to be a rule to take a vector at Q and bring it to P. And that rule typically is called parallel transport. And it tends to be called that regardless of whether that rule has anything to do with taking a vector very carefully and making sure that as we take it from this point to that point, we keep its direction fixed. So that's what we would normally understand by parallel transport. When translated into more abstract terms in differential geometry, that rule of parallel transport may not have any association with that intuitive picture, but nevertheless, it's a rule, and it could be an arbitrary rule to say when we're given a vector at Q, we can take that connection and bring that vector at P. So the idea is that we have a rule that takes this vector at P and will give us a new vector, it takes the vector at Q, and it will give us a new vector at P that we're going to call the transported vector. And it's going to be transported according to that rule gamma. So all of this is very abstract, but what it really means in practice is that we're going to have an operation that allows us to define a derivative of a vector. But the price to pay, or the way to make this happen, is to introduce a new structure in space-time that a priori, in abstract differential geometry, doesn't have anything to do with the metric. It's a new thing. It's a new quantity. It's a new object that we introduce on a manifold that allows us to do that. So it's a new structure. And fundamentally, it's thought to be completely independent from the metric. Although soon enough, we're going to make it very directly related to the metric, and then we're going to call that connection the Christoffel symbols, and we're going to do our covariant derivatives in the usual way. But I just wanted to insist on the fact that, in more abstract terms, a connection is just a rule to take a vector at a point, bring it to another point. And once we have that, well, we can define the derivative of the vector to be the difference between the transported vector and the original vector at P, because now we're combining vectors that belong to the same vector space. So the derivative is basically going to be the difference between the original vector at p and the transported vector at p, and that's going to be a perfectly fine, perfectly allowed operation, because we're taking a difference between two vectors that belong to the same vector space. So that's the main thing about covariant derivatives, is the fact that we can achieve this at the cost of introducing that new structure. Now, I'm not going to belabor the details here, but you know how it goes, right? So we're going to define a covariant derivative of a vector to be this operation here, where first we would take the vector functions, and we would take an ordinary derivatives with respect to our coordinates. We would have that term, but that by itself would not be a proper vectorial or tensorial operation. In order to make it so, what we're going to do is to add the connection term. And by doing all of that, we would have something that produces a proper tensor, because it's been defined according to that, you know, proper way of doing things, which involves that that connection rule. So let me restate this, because I may not have been clear. So conceptually, the idea is that, well, we cannot compare this to that. We cannot take the difference between v at q and v at p directly, because they belong to different vector spaces. So we introduce that rule to take the vector at q, bring it to p, that's the transported vector. And now we have a difference of vectors we can actually construct. And that's the idea of defining the covariant derivative. So I should have said covariant derivatives. In practice, what it all means is that when we do it with a coordinate system and we have, you know, vector components in a given coordinate system, what we do to construct the covariant derivative, which is a proper tensor, is to take the partial derivative, which is not a proper tensor, combine it with the connection, which is by itself not a proper tensor, but when we combine everything like this, we get something that's a proper tensor. So in the old way of doing things, in the tensor calculus approach, we would, show that this quantity here all by itself does not transform properly as a tensor under a coordinate transformation. And we would introduce this object here that would have such a transformation property as to cancel out the bad stuff here, so that the combination is perfectly okay. And that's what the connection achieves. That's the more conceptual view. That's the more pedestrian view. Regardless, in order to differentiate tensors, we have to introduce that kind of additional entity that allows us to define all of these things in a proper tensorial way, in a way that is, correct in the more abstract way of thinking, or just in the coordinate way of thinking. So that's the idea of covariant derivatives. And the main point that I wanted to make here is that there's a conceptual underpinning to this. And at the very start, we're thinking of this as an object that is a new structure on space-time that a priori has nothing to do with the metric. And there's lots of formulations of differential geometry and lots of different, settings here where we can keep the connection completely separate from the metric and have basically two basic structures on the manifold, the metric and the connection, living in parallel without having anything to do with each other. So I'm still going to take that point of view, and soon I'll specialize to the actual connection of GR, where we get it by imposing some conditions on the connection. I'll come to that in a moment. But before I do that, I want to extend the definition of covariant derivative, take it away from vectors, and extend it to, well, scalars, and then covectors, and then, tensors. And the way that this is done is to rely on the Leibniz property of all differential operators. So we want to extend to other tensors And we're going to do this with Leibniz. I may have spelled it wrong. And the idea is this. So first of all, what we're going to do is to say that the covariant derivative acting on a scalar that's just going to be the same thing by definition as the usual partial derivative. And the partial derivative being a gradient operation that defines a covector, and that's a proper covector. And we can denote it like this or denote it like that. It makes no difference. So that's going to be the first step to extend the notion of covariant derivative to other objects, and then to extend it to covectors and tensors. And all of that stuff, we're going to rely on the Leibniz rule, which will say that if you have a product of things, and they might have any number of indices, the covariant derivative of that product is going to be the product of the covariant derivatives. That's the Leibniz property, and that's something we always impose on any notion of derivative operator to make it a proper derivative operator. And with that, we can systematically extend the covariant derivative to any object that we wish. So I'll just do an example here. If we want to extend it to a covector, well, I need to do two things. So first, I will say that, so if I have a scalar that I get by combining a covector and an arbitrary vector v, so my vector v here is going to be a completely arbitrary thing. If I have this product over here, which is a scalar, and I act on it with a covariant derivative, then that's going to be the same thing as the partial derivative of that scalar. So I can write that down. And then the partial derivative, of course, is satisfying the Leibniz property. So I can make use of this and say that this is going to be the partial on omega times v plus v times, omega times the partial on v.
Is there any good physical
situation for the Leibniz? I don't know whether that's, I don't think I can give you one. Anyone has any ideas about how to provide the Leibniz rule with some physical intuition? Yeah, good question, but no good answer. Sorry. Right. Okay, so that's the first step. And the second step is to use the Leibniz rule on the product itself and say that while this product, this covariant derivative here can be re-expressed as the covariant derivative of the covector plus the covariant derivative of the vector. And then those two lines are equal to one another, so I can just make them equal. And what I'm going to do is to isolate this over here. I'm going to put that on the left-hand side. Sorry, that's the wrong index. So as a result of this, combining those two lines, I have that this stuff over here that I'm going to put to the left, well, that's going to be equal to minus this. So let me, so I'm putting all of this to the other side. So that's going to be equal to minus that over here. And this I will make explicit in terms of the connection and the partial derivative. Going to write it like that. And then all of that is equal to this. So it's going to be equal to that over here. So that's good. So let's see. So we have some cancellation. So that over here after multiplication by omega is exactly the same as this. So I can cancel that with this. And then what I'm going to do is to write what remains on the right-hand side in a slightly different way. So I'm going to write it still as partial acting on omega, and I'm going to factorize the V beta at the end. And what I'm going to do here is to wait a sec. Yeah, okay. And then I have to write that term over here. So what I want to do here is to write this combination of terms here where I have omega beta gamma V gamma. I want to write it in a way where I'm going to shuffle the indices to make the factorization of V beta possible. So I'm going to replace this beta and this repeated beta by gamma. Alpha I have to leave alone because it's a free index that's not being summed over. But this repeated gamma I can change into a beta. And now I have those two factors of V beta that are common to each term, and I can factorize it like that. So this kind of business where you rename indices at will, those that are repeated and summed over, those dummy indices that we do all the time. So that's part of the operation here. And now we're done because all of this here, while we have a V beta multiplying both sides, but that vector field that I introduced here for the calculation is completely arbitrary. The identity is valid for any choice of vector field. And that means that that must be equal to that. And that gives us a definition for the covariant derivative of a covector in terms of a partial derivative and in terms of the connection. So what we've done here is to basically start with a definition that applies only to vectors. Then we extended it to scalars in a sort of trivial way. And then we used the Leibniz property to extend the definition to a covector. And then we could just keep going like this and extend it to a two-index tensor, three-index tensor. We can just keep going like this. And that would give us all the standard rules of how to calculate covariant derivatives of various things. So I don't think anything here will appear to be surprising. But again, I wanted to outline the conceptual underpinnings of all of this and deal with the situation, as I said, where we can think of the connection as being its own thing, its own structure in space-time, completely independent of the metric. We can define covariant derivatives independently of a metric because the connection doesn't have to relate to a metric. Very good examples of this occur in field theory when you define a connection based on a group structure associated with a collection of fields, as in Yang-Mills theory. There are notions of covariant derivatives in that context that have really nothing to do with metrics at all, but they do implicate a connection that allows different quantities at different points to be compared to one another. Okay, so that's the covariant derivative. And I'm not going to keep doing this because I think you know what the rules are to do covariant derivatives of various tensors. And once you know how to do it for vectors and covectors, well, then, you know, every time you have a collection of indices, it's basically adding a whole bunch of connection terms for each free index that the tensor possesses. And then you do, you know, it becomes a pretty straightforward thing to do. But, you know, that's where all of those rules come from. And the key ingredient here was the Leibniz property. So derivative operators in physics or in mathematics are always defined with that in mind, that they have to satisfy the Leibniz property. That's a pretty universal thing. Yep?
Yeah, this Leibniz is just, I mean, we know that the normal derivative satisfies Leibniz property.
Right.
Like limits of the f, the x minus f. So we want this, so that's the requirement.
Right.
In principle, maybe do greater Leibniz, right?
Sorry?
Could have maybe made a greater Leibniz rule, right? Like introduce a plus or minus there. So that would be.
Oh, you think we could introduce a minus sign here?
Yeah. We would have graded, like I remember, like for Grassmann numbers, you would have graded, like for example.
Okay.
No?
Okay, yeah, maybe. I'm not familiar with that, but yeah. So maybe it's possible to generalize the notion of differential operators. You would have a generalized version or, you know, slightly something different from Leibniz. But I think in general in physics, we tend to stick with Leibniz. And you know, we only call it a differential operator if it satisfies that property. Okay, so we're basically coming to the end of the lecture, but I'll just say that, well, in GR, you know, we actually make a connection between the metric and the connection by imposing two properties. And those properties are, you know, very well motivated from physics. They, you know, they're things that are justified or, you know, motivated by the principle of equivalence and things like that. But nevertheless, those are additional rules that we put in our formulation of the differential geometry that's going to be relevant for gravity. So the connection in GR, well, we impose two conditions on the connection. First, we impose that it should be symmetric. So gamma beta alpha is going to be identical to gamma alpha beta. So that's something that we imposed that was not required a priori. We could have connections that are not symmetric, and you know, there are some examples of that. And we impose also that it should be metric compatible. And that means that we declare that the covariant derivative of the metric will be zero. So again, that's something that we impose because we want that for physics. That's not something that's of necessity from the point of view of mathematics, either one of those. And sure enough, people have formulated differential geometries where none of those conditions are satisfied. And some people have ported that to physics by using those generalized constructions to construct alternative theories of gravity. So for example, you have theories of gravity where the connection is not symmetric and the antisymmetric part of the connection is called the torsion. And that gives you a torsion theory of gravity. And you know, that's been popular in some corners. And you can also introduce a connection that's not metric compatible. You would introduce a non-zero right-hand side to replace that, and that would be an additional field in space-time for which you can make up field equations, and that would give you another avenue to develop an alternative theory of gravity, and that's been popular in some corners. But here we're going to stick with theories of gravity, I mean GR in particular, but a whole bunch of theories of gravity where all of those things are actually satisfied. And if you work this out, then that gives you an explicit formula for the connection in this case. So when we combine those two equations, we get that the connection can be expressed explicitly in terms of the metric and its derivative, and we get the usual Christoffel symbols. So in that context, they're called Christoffel symbol. And those are the ones that, you know, we play with all the time in GR. And that's a specific choice of connection that is relevant for us in this part of physics. But again, the main point is that, well, this is something that we choose from the mathematics. The mathematics allow for a lot more generality. We impose those additional conditions so that we get that, and then basically we get a very intimate connection between the metric and the connection. They're no longer independent, they're very much connected. And you know, that's the choice that we make in order to formulate our laws of physics. And as I said, you know, people have, you know, considered alternative possibilities. There's a whole slew of things you can do beyond these choices here, but you know, we're going to be happy to impose that, and that's going to be what I'm going to do for the rest of the semester. Okay, so I think that's enough for this morning, and before we break, any questions about any of this? We're all satisfied? Is it all obvious, or is it
Yep. Benefit to choosing a connection so that as you transport the vector, it doesn't change at all, so the vector would vanish. could either gain insight from the curvature of the manifold.
So I think you, I don't think you could do this for any vector. I think you would have to pick maybe a vector or two or three where you would impose that property on the connection, and that would be your, you know, the Tom connection. And I don't know why that would be useful. You would have to, you know, introduce some preferred vectors that you happen to like, and maybe, you know, they would be physically meaningful, but I don't know what you would do with that. Yeah. Hassan, you had a question?
Yeah, this entity company, why? The first day I couldn't get why they chose this condition.
Yeah, so it that's a very good question, and it's a very deep question. So it has to do with the fact that when you formulate a metric theory of gravity, one of the things that you impose is that, let's see, how do I want to say this? So it has to do with the principle of equivalence. So you want to introduce a geometry where free-falling observers don't see the effect of gravity. And that means that in the frame of a free-falling observer, the metric has to reduce to the Minkowski metric with no inertial terms. So that the only deviation from the flat space metric that you would see in your local vicinity would have to come from curvature. And that translates into metric compatibility. So it's a deep-rooted, it's a deep-rooted condition that arises from the principle of equivalence and the desire to have that kind of gravity. Other questions? Okay, so we'll reconvene in the afternoon.